first sight in real space the refugees from Worcester Preparatory got of the Epsilon Eridani system, aside from the gleaming yellow-white disk of Bahava L off to one side, was the glimmering band of thousands of lights. As Charlemagne reduced speed and altered course slightly, a few of the lights resolved themselves into solid objects, visible as pinheads against a speckled velvet sky. That any starship should be visible as a solid object at nearly 100,000 kilometers distance only showed how immense the central ship of the vast armada actually was. The Freespacers were here, of course, because many of their number were contractors on the Babylon project. After all, if you needed a large and willing labor pool, skilled at space construction and willing to do a long, complicated job in the middle of nowhere, who else was there? As one of the chief signatory nations to the Pact Babylonica in the first place, the Confederate Free Spacers Alliance was happy to lend its vast capability for space construction to the effort. For the going rate, of course. Business, after all, is business, and a nomad nation's got to make a living. It is impossible to see the incredible motley array of the 2,000-plus ship Freespacer home fleet for the first time and not be amazed. There, juxtaposed against the finest in military ships and the most graceful of large private ships, cruised bastard monstrosities and flying junk piles, elegant cruise ships parked in orbit alongside old orbital stations with a hyperdrive tacked onto the hull. The fleet spanned hundreds of kilometers in all three dimensions, a perambulating constellation of light and duralloy. It really was a shame that, as several of the group gawked and gaped at the fleet, the one person in the group best qualified to act as tour guide was in no condition to do so. Max slowly pried his hands off the armrests of the chair he'd sat in 48 minutes previously, having managed not a particle of relaxation in all that time. Cold sweat continued to run down his pale skin as he slowly pushed himself up, forced himself to take deep breaths, and slowly ran through the mental inventory that assured him that, yes, he had managed another superlight journey intact. Moose, noting Mac's shocky appearance, called out, "Hey, Mac, are you sure you're all right?"
Fine.
Mac nodded shakily.
"It's just good to be home."
"What I can't understand," Mia mused, "is why the Freespacers went to so much trouble for one boy." She smiled at Mac, who was beginning to regain a bit of color as he looked over the home fleet. "I never knew you were so important, Mac." "I'm not important at all," Mac shrugged. "One of 50,000 potential midshipsmen and shipowned and families in the Alliance. No political friends or enemies to speak of. But," he added, looking dead at Mia as he continued, "to us, the Psi Corps is important. You don't realize just how important. While I was being extracted, across Earth about 200 other Free Spacer nationals left the planet in less flashy exits. All of them were on secure supply fleet contract vessels, except for those leaving under their own power. At this point, the only Free Spacers remaining on the Earth are our ambassadors to Earthdome, the Republic of Texas, the Argentine Empire, and the Principality of Zanzibar. And I predict that by the end of the week, Ambassador Fenwick will be posted somewhere other than Geneva." He smirked as he added, "I hear there's an opening for the B-5 delegation." "That's not a full explanation," Jury objected. "I'll grant that the CFMF doesn't want the Psi Corps to take its citizens, but why is it willing to defy Earth Force and the Corps for the sake of non-citizens like the rest of us?" Mac sighed, gathered his thoughts, and said, "The Freespacers have always been the last chance for those seeking a new life, who wanted to put behind them past mistakes. We offer asylum to those who are sincerely dedicated to change, no matter what their past crimes are. Well, within reason, but that is the theory. Because of that, we've had a very rocky relationship with law enforcement of all types, including the 3WA and the Zardon Justice Department. Even the current honeymoon with the experts of justice can't last forever. But the Psi Corps is a law enforcement agency that doesn't hunt you for what you've done. It wants you for who you are. for a fluke of genetics that we have no control over. Why not a Lemurian legion to hunt down members of the Ancients of Mu? Why not a Kilrathi cadre to seek out naturalized Kilrathi refugees and detain them? Why not a plump platoon to jail anyone who happens to be fat? No one laughed. Considering Mac's serious expression, this was probably a good thing for them. Not only is Earth violating the rights protected by the Federation, he continued, it is forgetting its own history. And the Federation is letting them get away with it, largely because Earth damn near controls the Federation as it is. But the Freespacers haven't forgotten, because too many of us are refugees of one kind or another, sometimes because of things we've done, sometimes because we happen to be a kind of person someone else doesn't like. And we protect our own. He leaned back in his chair again and went from looking intense to looking very, very tired. Even people like Devlin, who don't realize they're our kind of people yet. Daggerdisk came out of hyperspace a little more than half an hour later, skirted the Freespacer home fleet, and made for the largest non-natural object in the system, the 5-mile-long cylindrical space station orbiting the second planet, not far from the local metaspace jump gate. International Police Station Babylon 5 was not yet officially open for business, but it was functionally complete and fully operational. A skeletal remnant of the construction crews were finishing up the last of the fittings and details, and the Freespacers who had built it were getting set to move on as soon as they were satisfied that this one, unlike its 4 predecessors, wasn't going to blow up under suspicious circumstances, or vanish mysteriously, or anything annoying like that. Corwin was about to make contact with the station's control center when another ship arrived on the scene, dashing in at warp speed and then dropping to impulse power and forming up on Daggerdisk's flank. Compared to Daggerdisk, which could have landed in her shuttle bay, the ship was vast, though she paled in comparison to the 5-mile bulk of Babylon 5. Her sweeping lines, ovoid main hull blending smoothly back into engineering hull, elegant warp nacelles, pearlescent tritanium alloy hull plating, made her look fast even standing still, despite her immensity. At this range, the 8-pointed star of the International Police Organization's Space Force was clearly visible on the side of her secondary hull. 4 cardinal points enlarged and southern point elongated, with text trailing it in bold microgramma capitals. Starship IPS Challenger, International Police Organization. The communications panel chirped, and for the first time since leaving New Avalon, Corwin cared what it had to say. He tabbed a couple of controls to acknowledge and open a voice channel on the backup transceiver, and a fairly familiar voice spoke to him. Daggerdisk, this is the International Police Starship Challenger. Oh boy, thought Corwin, here it comes. Challenger was his father's command, the Experts of Justice nascent space fleet's first battleship, and that meant he was definitely going to get it. But the voice surprised him by not taking him to task. Instead, calmly, briskly, and professionally, it went on, Our sensors indicate battle damage to your vessel. Do you have wounded aboard? What is your status? Please respond. Corwin blinked, suppressed his surprise, and keyed his push-to-talk. That's unknown at this time. Some of my passengers may be injured. I've been too busy to take a survey. My intentions were to dock at Babylon 5 and seek assistance. The ship is spaceworthy. No major systems damage. Roger that, Daggerdisk. Glad you're okay. Transferring you to Babylon 5 approach control now. Challenger out. Wow, thought Corwin. Dad didn't even get on the line himself, and he didn't have Hoshi bawl me out for him. Then he added glumly, Must want to save it until he can bawl me out in person. His attention was then commanded by the calm, brisk voice of B-5's deck officer, who guided him into the approach pattern and cued him to slave Daggerdisk's helm to the station's automatic docking system. Once they were aboard and secured in a docking bay, Corwin locked down all systems, shut the ship down, and finally went aft to see how his passengers were doing. They were a rather shell-shocked-looking lot. Utrina and Kate were in one side of the wardroom booth, Wakaba and Sayanji in the other, all clearly worried. Devlin Carter was stretched out on the couch, looking as if someone had beaten the hell out of him with a purpose, then gone back and done it again just for fun. Amanda Dessler knelt by his head, looking not too much better off herself. Dorothy and Miki stood leaning against the bulkhead. There was a burn scar across her right cheek, and both looked generally dirty and battered. And where'd she get that cat? Professor Krolg sat cross-legged in the center of the room with a batleth laid across his knees, meditating. Liza Broadbank was all the way on the other side of the room, as far away from the others as she could get, sitting in a miserable huddle on a packing case. Before he could say anything, Nall came to his shoulder from Miki's, nudging up in a silent gesture of apology for his earlier thoughtlessness. Corwin reached up and scratched absently at his ears to let him know there were no hard feelings. Amanda rose to her feet, wincing slightly as the motion gave her pain. Then she came and squared herself to attention in front of him and bowed, though this, too, was clearly a very uncomfortable act. "Lord Corwin," she said, "I owe you my life." She glanced at Devlin. "And that of my beloved as well." Corwin held up his hand, a faintly pleading look on his face, and told her somewhat fumblingly, "Please, don't. I can't... right now." She seemed to understand, nodding. He went to the ramp release and let it down gently this time. "Better just leave him there and let the medtechs move him," he said, to which Amanda nodded again. Dorothy and Caitlin, the former with the gray cat in her arms, the latter carrying Lesser Mazinger in a side pocket, flanked him as he moved down the ramp to face the music. Utina, with Tiny Robo under her arm, was right behind him, Sayanji, Wakaba, and Miki right behind her, Krolg following silently. The med team rushed across the docking bay and up to them. They declined treatment and indicated that the injured were within, then continued out of the ship and into the bay itself. This was a room about the size of a football stadium. Dagger Disc was magnetically moored to a mobile platform which took up about 3/4 of the floor space and could move on mag tracks to deliver the ship back to the station's central column and thus outside through the master lock. The rest of it was a metal-decked floor that led to the large freight door off to one side. This door opened for a second time as they approached it, and in came a small group of uniformed personnel. Corwin didn't recognize all of them, but the two in the spearhead he most certainly did. One of them was the short, slim, blue-silver-haired form of Lieutenant Ruri Hoshino, his father's yeoman and probably the smallest humanoid lensman in the galaxy. Crisply dressed in black miniskirt, white dress shirt and black tie, orange vested and perpetually bored-looking, Ruri looked to be only about 12 years old, but she had for as long as Corwin had known her, which was most of his life. No one seemed to know how old she was, where she came from, or even precisely what species she was. But she had passed the test of light and wore the lens, so none of that seemed all that important. She trotted alongside her boss, Kai Cho, the big kahuna, he who could not run things without Ruri. Fleet Captain Ben Griffin Hutchins, late of the WDF and currently the Chief of the Experts of Justice, Director of IPO Operations, and Commander of the IPO's fledgling Space Force. This figure, stocky and broad but a surprisingly fast walker, strode across the bay with a hard-to-read scowl of concentrated something on his round, bearded face. Under his outback duster, into the pockets of which his hands were thrust, he wore the grayish-blue-shouldered black jacket and pants of the IPO Space Force, and there was a red-lettered black NX-04462 ball cap on his head. The rest of them stopped a dozen paces or so away. Ruri, hands behind her back, looked over Dagger Disc, then made eye contact with Corwin and shook her head with an expression of disappointment laced with ennui. Corwin gave her a faint, "What could I do?" kind of shrug, then looked at his still-approaching father and braced himself for the explosion. Instead of exploding, though, Griffin strode up to his son and grabbed him up in a powerful, almost crushing hug, slapping him on the back, scruffling up Noll at the same time, and generally making a somewhat embarrassing spectacle of himself. Releasing him, he proceeded to apply the same treatment to Caitlin, then Dorothy, then Uchina, then Wakaba, somewhat to her surprise, then Miki, considerably to his. Sionji and Krog only got handshakes, since he'd never met them before. Then, and only then, did Griffin round on Corwin and speak. "Your friends are with the Free Spacers," he said. "They're all safe. Everyone got out. Admiral Curtis's people are putting them up on the New Orleans for now. We'll move them over here tomorrow, but Terry and I figured they'd had enough excitement for one day. Are you okay?" "Fine," said Corwin, his surprise plain on his face. "Devlin and Amanda look to be in pretty rough shape, but the rest of us are okay, I think." Griffin looked the others over and decided he could concur with that assessment, aside from Dorothy's burned face, which he brushed with a finger as he gave her a concerned look. "It's nothing," she told him. "I've blocked the pain receptors in that area." "I can fix that in a few seconds," Corwin added, nodding. Griffin nodded, satisfied, put a hand on her shoulder and smiled at her, and then turned as the medtechs brought their stretcher down out of Dagger Disk with its battered burden. "His name," Amanda informed them as she irritatedly brushed off another tech who kept trying to attach an IV to her arm, "is Devlin Carter. He's an Earthman, blood type B negative. He's a telepath, rating P12. He suffered a severe psychic shock in mental combat with the Psycop." "So have you," one of the techs informed her, pointing to his own Red Cross Medtech's badge. The center of the cross bore an inlaid black letter Psi. "Don't get excited," he said, holding up a hand. "I'm with the Experts of Justice. I'm an Anodyne, and I've sworn the Hippocratic just like everybody else here," he added, indicating the rest of the trauma team with a sweeping gesture. "Just relax. Let Elaine set your IV and come with us to Medlab. Nobody's going to hurt you or your friend here on this station." Amanda gave the Bajoran medtech a long, hard look, her cyber-optic glowing dully through the one-way lens of the metal cowl sealing off her right eye socket. Then she nodded, slowly, and followed them out, pausing only to clasp the hands of her friends in turn and tell them that she would see them as soon as she was assured that Devlin was out of danger. Hesitantly, slowly, Liza came down the ramp as well, careful not to look at anyone. Griffin cocked an eyebrow, surprised to see her, of all people, there. But Caitlin caught his eye and shook her head slightly, so he didn't approach, letting one of the B-5 security officers take her in hand instead, and lead her off to temporary quarters and rest. Instead of getting involved in that, Griffin went off a little way, put his hands in his trouser pockets, and surveyed his ship. "Boy," he observed at length, "you gave her a hell of a run." Corwin came up beside him and nodded uncertainly. "Yeah. Listen, Dad, I'm sorry. I stole your ship and got it shot up. I even used the systems I'm not supposed to use. I broke a whole fistful of rules, but I didn't have any choice. The Corps would have them by now if I hadn't gone when I did, as fast as I did. They were getting ready for a major assault just as I arrived. They could have died, all of them. I..." Griffin held up a hand without turning to look at his son, and Corwin trailed off. "My hope," the elder said in a calm, even voice, "is that you've learned something very important today. Would you like to guess what that something is?" No, said Corwin. Slowly, Griffin turned to face his son, put a hand on the shoulder that wasn't occupied by Noll, and looked him in the eye. "Two things, actually. Thing one, rules are all well and good, but there are times when following them is the wrong thing." A smile stole onto Corwin's face as his heart swelled with hope. Did that mean what he thought it meant? That his father not only wasn't going to punish him for his actions, but he approved of them? Griffin nodded as if he'd read the thought. "You did just what you had to do today, son. You heard the cry for help. God knows how, but it's obvious you did. And you didn't waste any time dithering. You knew what you had to do, and you did it without hesitation. You used every tool at your disposal to get the job done. He shook his head, blue eyes tearing up a little, and then yanked Corwin into another crushing, backslapping hug as he added, "Your mother's name, I'm proud of you." Dumbstruck, Corwin returned the embrace, a bit lamely at first, and then with more feeling as all that had just been said to him sunk in. He said, then stopped, fumbled with words for a moment, and settled for, "Thanks, that means a lot." "Speaking of your mother, she's proud of you too," added Griffin as he released his son, then put an arm over the boy's shoulders and led him away from the ship and back toward his friends. "She'll be along to tell you so herself once she's done with her business in Asgard. Some things even the Norn of tomorrow can't get out of until tomorrow." Corwin smiled. "Figures." Then he looked thoughtful for a moment and asked, "What was the second thing?" "The second thing?" asked Griffin. "Yeah, you said you hoped I'd learn two important things today. What was the second one?" "Oh, right." Griffin grinned and angled a thumb back toward the ship, taking in with that one gesture all her various wounds, the blaster scars, the blown shield projectors, the atmospheric charring, the smashed comm dish. "Thing two. You broke it, you bought it." After Griffin had a chance to consult a bit more with his children in a private conference off to the side of the docking bay, they all went to the conference room in the station's command center, in between the commander's office and the command deck, where there would be room for them all to talk. Griffin introduced those who didn't know her to Ruri, and then introduced them all to the station's command staff. Commander Jer Johnson was one of the Wedge Defense Force old-timers, a Detianized human of Earth origins, a year or two older than Griffin was. He was of medium height and very slim, with a sharply defined face that looked, even under the present somber circumstances, somewhat mischievous, and a disorderly shock of blonde and blue hair under a floppy gray cap that looked a little out of place with his gray and black IPO Space Force uniform. His jacket was unzipped, revealing a slash of his mustard-yellow command branch undershirt, and his shoes could have used shining. Oddest of all, he appeared to have a white rabbit sitting on his shoulder. In sharp contrast to Commander Johnson's eclectic informality was his deputy, Lieutenant Commander Susan Ivanova. Ivanova was a rather severe-looking beauty, with her brown hair pulled back into a vicious French braid, and a scowl on her face that was most easily interpreted as universal disapproval. She was an officer of the United Federation of Planets Starfleet, giving deputy command of the station as part of the Federation's cooperative involvement in the Babylon Project. So her uniform was the trim black and burgundy of a Starfleet command officer, rather than IPSF gray, blue, and black. Clearly, she found the present situation somewhat distressing, but she didn't comment on it, merely nodding cordially, if curtly, to each of the youngsters as they were introduced in turn. The third was another woman, as lovely as Ivanova, but somewhat less severe, though she did seem annoyed about something. As the station's chief of security, Major Kira Nerys usually seemed annoyed about something. Apart from the headaches of getting a place this large, staffed, and operational, there was the perpetual joy of working in a command environment where nobody wore the same uniform. Hers, for example, was a sort of pale orange, with commando-style shoulder patches and soft boots, the uniform of the Bajoran Armed Forces. The joint administration of this station was either going to be a revolutionary exercise in interagency cooperation or an absolute nightmare. Kira wasn't sure which yet. The refugees settled themselves at the large conference table in the middle of the room with murmured small talk and worried looks. Ruri went to the table at the back and brought over a tray of refreshments. As she arranged them, she gave Corwin a subtle poke in the ribs and the faintest suggestion of a conspiratorial smile, then slipped quietly from the room. Griffin took a sip of what smelled like mint tea, then switched on the television at the end of the table, which was tuned to Network 23. just in time to see one of Truss's battle droids knock Roger Tremaine on his keister through the magic of previously recorded. That was the scene a bit less than 3 hours ago, here on the campus of what was one of the galaxy's finest private high schools, said the voice of John Trussell. The image flicked back to the present, showing Truss standing at what appeared to be the bottom of his Lambda shuttle's ramp. Behind him they could see the quad, the parking lot, and a lot of broken glass littering the sidewalks in front of all the buildings, plus the still-smoking wreckage of several Psi-Corps vehicles. "It's all over here now but the administrative screaming," Truss reported, "and still the simplest questions surrounding this bizarre, violent incident have yet to be answered. Why were the Psi-Corps here? What did they want? Why did they employ such extreme measures to get it? And who thwarted them?" The Corps' Regional Director for the Northeastern United States, Psi-Cop Roger Tremaine, doesn't want these questions answered, said Truss as the camera zoomed in a little tighter on his serious, sincere face. It was one of the 5 most trusted faces in the known galaxy, according to the perennial Galactic News Service poll, and all over the Earth Alliance and beyond, billions of eyes were watching it intently as it went on firmly. "But in the next hour, I intend to answer every one of them. Live and direct from Worcester, Massachusetts, I'm John Trussell, and this is Network 23. Griffin grinned. "Go get him, Truss." He switched the TV off again and said conversationally, "You know, Network 23 is our best asset inside the Alliance, and they don't even take orders from us." "They wouldn't be much of a news agency if they took orders from a political entity," Ivanova said pointedly. "That's very true," Griffin replied agreeably. "Look at ISN. Ivanova glared at him, but said nothing. Kira, who Caitlin could have sworn was hiding a snicker, got up and went to the corner of the room to have a hushed conversation with her chirping comlink. When she returned, she smiled at the WPI students and said, "Well, you'll be happy to know that 4 more from your school have turned up safe and sound. It seems one Edward Tversky trashed the Earth Medigate's authorization codes, and your RA just flew herself, Tversky, a dog, and a duffel bag full of antique AI parts in with the stolen Psi-Corps runabout. They've just landed in Bay 4. The refugees smiled with relief, even Dorothy. Griffin got up from the table and said, "You guys relax here for a bit. I have to go and see about a few things." He said it with lightness in his voice, but there was something in his eyes that contradicted it. He nodded around the table, then left the room. Utrina remembered Kate telling her that those who wore the lens could communicate silently with each other. Had he just received such a message? If he had, it hadn't been good news. She glanced at Kate and saw that the fact hadn't eluded her notice either, nor Corwin's. Before she could comment, however, her train of thought was interrupted by Commander Johnson, who came over next to her chair and plopped his white rabbit into her lap with a smiling comment, "Here, have a bunny." "Huh? Oh, thank you," said Utrina, petting the rabbit. "What's his name?" "J.R. She's a her," said Jer. "Bailey's around here somewhere, but he's gray, so he's hard to spot in this room." Looking around at the gray wall coverings, gray carpet, and gray furniture, Utrina had to admit he had something there. "What's your cat's name?" Jer asked Dorothy. "Peril," Dorothy replied. Jer looked thoughtful, then smiled. "Good name for a cat." "Especially this one," Dorothy said, nodding. "What have we got, Ruri?" Griffin asked as he entered the station control room. "The Gamelon Grand Fleet has just defaulted in the solar system," Ruri informed him. "Emperor Deslok himself is commanding. It appears he intends to destroy the Earth in retaliation for the Psi-Corps' treatment of his heir." Griffin dropped his face into his palm. "Wonderful," he said. "Can you get me in touch with Earthdome?" "I can try," Ruri replied blandly. She went to the comm station, nonchalantly moved the young Starfleet officer on duty there out of the way, and started plying the controls. Griffin sighed and pulled an antique cybergenics communicator out of one of the pockets of his drover coat, then flicked it open. "Zoner," he said. A moment later, Megazone strode through the control room doors. "Yo," he said. Griffin closed the communicator and put it away. "Princess Amanda Dessler of Gamelon is in Medlab," he said. "Her father, on the other hand, is headed for Earth orbit with an afternoon program of light music and comet bombardment planned. I need you to take her to him and see if the two of you can maybe convince him not to do that." Zoner nodded. "I'm on it," he said, and went back out. Amanda would never be able to describe precisely how it had happened. One moment, after receiving Devlin Carter's flat insistence that he would be all right and she must go at once, she had accompanied Zoner out of the door of Medlab, expecting to be hustled to the docking bays or transporter rooms, and thence to a ship and off to metaspace. Instead, they emerged from the Medlab door and into the Bridge of the Destiny's Fist, flagship of the Imperial Gamelon Navy. The two guards flanking the doorway started violently and spun as if to shoot, but Amanda, recovering her wits quickly, waved them back with her best flinty glare. Up on the command podium, Captain Dorlak and Grenlo Dragonar spun, their faces wearing looks of shock and faintly pleased surprise, respectively. A moment later, the white-coated, blue-caped figure they flanked turned more slowly to survey the two people coming up the stairs toward him. Zoner hung back and let Amanda precede him, following her with his hands in the pockets of his black leather coat and an unconcerned expression on his face. The princess strode quickly to the top of the stairs, ignoring the pain of her injuries, which she hadn't allowed to be treated while Devlin was still in need, and confronted her father without fear or hesitation. "Is it true, father?" she asked without preamble. "You intend to destroy the earth?" "They abducted my heir, beat her, tortured her. Do you think I would let that go unanswered?" Deslok replied, his voice cold. "How did you get here?" Dorlak demanded. "Be silent, Dorlak, you valueless toady," Amanda snapped. "I did not come here to be pestered by you. I came to prevent my father from committing an atrocity that will blacken the name of Gamelon forever." Deslok's eyes narrowed. "You would have me spare them?" he demanded, his voice rising just a touch into that very dangerous zone of quietness. "Yes, father, I would," Amanda replied flatly. She gestured to the blue-green disk of the earth, filling the fist's forward viewport, and said, "Look at it, father. 6 billion people make that world their home. That world is Devlin's home. Yes, their government is corrupt. Yes, agents of that government tortured me, and my friends, and one day I will make them pay for that. But 6 billion people, father!" She turned away, her imperious facade falling away. When she turned back, there was a tear in her good eye. "Earth is in the grip of a tyrannical madman and his cadre of liars and fools. Perhaps they deserve what you have planned for this world, but the world does not. It may be a planet ruled by corruption and fear, but it is a beautiful planet, and it is Devlin's homeworld. 6 billion of his countrymen don't deserve to die for what their leaders have done." She paced away from him a little on the command platform, then turned back, dashed away her tears, and said evenly, "Do not do this, father. I never ask anything of you, do I? Well, I ask you for this now. You have raised me to believe in justice, but this is not justice. It is merely revenge. Do not do this." Deslok stared hard at his daughter for several very tense seconds. Then he turned his back on her and said in a hard voice, "Captain Dorlak, ready the comet driver." "Father!" Amanda snapped. There was no pleading in her voice, only a hard, imperious anger, and Deslok actually stiffened slightly as it lashed his back before he turned to face her, his face cold. "You have something else you wish to say to me, Flight Leader Dessler?" he inquired. "Understand this, father. I will not permit you to destroy the Earth. Amanda told him flatly. Instinctively, she held up her right hand, flat, palm up. Without missing a beat, Megazone slapped a phaser pistol into it. The guards hissed in consternation, recoiling and raising their weapons as she leveled it unwaveringly at her father's broad chest. Even as they did so, they knew it would be useless for them to fire at her. She was on the Emperor's command podium. Its ray shields would prevent their own fire from reaching its target, while she, safely within them, could vaporize her father with impunity. Only Captain Dorlak and Grenlo Dragonar had any hope of stopping her. Dorlak appeared frozen in shock and or fear, his jaw hanging open, hands slack at his sides. Dragonar tensed and made as if to move forward, but suddenly Zonar was right behind Amanda, looming over her in height and width like a great black shadow, his right arm extended forward past her head. A fistful of large black gun winked at Grenlo, and the look in Megazone's eyes made it clear that if the Patriarch of the Dragonar insisted on dying in a vain attempt to save his Emperor, that was fine with Zonar. "I am already sworn to kill one member of our family," said Amanda calmly, her good eye fixed on her father's face. "Do not force me to make it two." Desluck arched an eyebrow. "You feel that strongly about it?" he asked her calmly. "I do," she replied. A beat. The corner of Desluck's mouth quirked very, very slightly. "Captain Dorlak," he said.
Sir?
Dorlak stammered, his hands shaking. "Stand down the comet, driver, secure from battle stations. Come about and begin plotting our fold home." Amanda relaxed, but only just perceptibly. Desluck looked at her with calm curiosity for a moment, then inquired, "Well, something else? Or are you planning to kill me anyway, and assume the throne that would one day have been yours regardless?" Amanda looked back at him for a moment, then thumbed the phaser offline and placed it without looking in Zoner's open left hand, which was suddenly ready for it. Slowly, the black-coated expert eased back from right behind her, his weapon tracking Grenlo Dragonar until the two pairs of them were back at opposite ends of the platform. Then he made it disappear inside his coat. Dragonar made a noise that was a strange combination of satisfaction and frustration.
"No, father," said Amanda, smiling thinly. "I would not kill you for my own gain. If you honestly believe I would, then you have never truly known me."
Abruptly, so unexpectedly that it broke the tension on the command platform like a brick through a window, Desluck smiled outright. "I trust," he said dryly, "this means I shall still be invited to the wedding." Amanda blushed, the scarlet overpowering the pale blue of her cheeks.
"I must seek Garen's approval before any definite plans can be made," she told him, but Desluck flipped a hand dismissively.
"Garen would approve a proposal to set him afire if it came from you," he said. "Keep me informed so that I may plan accordingly." Amanda smiled very slightly, put her heels together, and inclined her head.
"I shall, father."
"You may return to your schoolmates," said Desluck. With a dry smile for Zonar, he added, "I presume whatever special means you employed works both ways." Zonar nodded, then stood aside to let Amanda precede him down the stairs. At the top she paused, then turned back to face the Emperor.
"Father, I meant what I said. Many things I have let pass, out of deference to your desire for peace in your house, but this I cannot leave unanswered. I will kill Xenia."
Desluck regarded her for a moment with a hard-to-read expression, then nodded once, his face grave. Without another word, Amanda turned and descended. Zonar was about to follow her when Desluck said, "Megazone, a moment." The former Wedge Defender paused, half-turned, and regarded the Emperor of the Gamelons.
"Would you really have let her kill me?" inquired Desluck curiously.
Would you? Zoner replied with a shrouded smile. Then he turned and followed Amanda to the exit.